Welcome to the Klamath Tribes podcast. Today we are talking about the McLeod Rutenic Collection, as it is known. This is a collection of artifacts from the 19th and 20th centuries by three families. It began about 1869 or 1870 by a Pennsylvania banker named Amos Gottschall, who traveled throughout the West collecting Native American baskets and art. His collection later was purchased by the McLeod family, and the collection was greatly expanded by Edith Rutenic and her husband. Kenneth McLeod of Klamath Falls was also part of the avid collectors of this Modoc and Klamath art and artifacts. Jeff Mitchell was at the beginning of the investigation and research into this collection as the Klamath tribes worked to acquire it and eventually did. Jeff Mitchell's in studio, and I'm going to let him start with the story.
The collection actually started way, way back with a fellow by the name of Gottschall. He was a Pennsylvania banker that was in the banking business on the East Coast, and he made a fortune in the banking business, and he was very interested in Native culture, particularly on the West Coast. So every summer, he would leave Pennsylvania and travel to the West Coast and travel up and down the coast, introducing himself and meeting indigenous people from different tribes. And he was a collector of Indian art, not artifacts, art. Some people call them artifacts today, I guess. But he was an art collector, most of all, I think. And so he would meet with tribes and he would see what they created. And if he liked it, he would try to purchase it. And each year he would go to someplace different. And as he worked his way up from California, he finally got into Oregon and he got around the Klamath Modoc people. And he became fascinated with our art, our culture, and our history. And he started buying pieces of our art, mostly focusing on baskets, but also other artifacts, I'm saying that word myself, other art that was created. We used to be known for these beautiful duck robes that we would create and we would trade with other tribes. And these duck robes were beautiful. There's only a few that are still in existence
that
I know of.
What is
a duck robe?
Duck
robe. It's a robe that's made, and a person that's a duck hunter would go out, and when they capture ducks, they would actually take the breast feathers of a duck, and they would cut that off, and they would tan that with the feathers on. And when they accumulated enough of these, they would sew them together like a quilt, and then they would stuff them with duck down. And then they would put a backing of either antelope or deer hide. And they were beautiful. I mean, when you looked at them, you had this mosaic feature with all these different colors of all these different migratory birds. We're right in the middle of the Pacific Flyway. And the hydrology upper basin here was we had all these lakes and marshes. And waterfowl was a big part of our diet and our homes and our life. So we created these duck robes, and they're only done the way we did them by the Klamath and Modoc people. No other tribes did them because they didn't have the abundance of that resource that we did. So it was stuff like that he was looking for, Gottschall.
Do you know how to spell his name?
G-O-T-T-C-H, Gottschall. A-L, something like that. You can find it. I'll find it for you. I don't remember his first name offhand. I'd have to go back and look at it. I think it was Charles, but anyway.
The Gottschalls is a famous name in American finance and banking. So he was collecting. This is what year again?
We're in the 1800s. We're in the 1800s when he shows up. And what was interesting about him is that he wanted to ensure that he got the provenance of each piece. And he wasn't your ordinary collector. He had these leather-bound journals. And when we acquired the collection, I think there's up to almost 15 of them. And everything that he acquired, he would enter into that journal. He would number it.
Like a bank of wood.
And he would say what the piece was. If it was a basket, he would ask the person, if you made it, what's this design? What's the material? He documented what he paid for it, you know, how much it cost him. He would document the person's name, who he acquired it from. I mean, the guy was a little bit odd in that sense. He wanted to make sure that he got as much information, not just the piece, but he wanted to know about the person that made it and how they made it. And he put that in his journals, every piece he collected. And there was, in the baskets and the war artifacts, I think there's over 7,000 pieces that are entered into these journals. And on the paper side, there was three pieces of this collection: the baskets, stuff from the Modoc War, artifacts from the Modoc War on both sides, Calvary and the United States and the Modoc people. And then he collected original documents from the early settlement of this region, journals, papers, maps, and altogether the collection has about 15,000 pieces in it. And so he spent this time doing this. Eventually he lives his life out. Another person by the name of McLeod comes into the region, and he ends up purchasing this entire collection that this guy has. And he was doing the same thing, McLeod. And McLeod did the same thing with the provenance. He entered it, he carried on the same thing that Gottschall was doing, and he documented everything that he put into this collection. Eventually, McLeod meets another person by the name of Rutnick. And Rutnick was also a private collector. And they developed this relationship. And McLeod lived in Klamath Falls, owned a nice home in Klamath Falls. He ends up buying Rutnick out. So now McLeod amasses this huge collection of Klamath Modoc art and artifacts. It was the largest privately known collection in existence. Thousands of pieces. And this guy spent a lifetime accumulating this collection because it meant something to him, this art, this history. Eventually he passes on, and the collection stays in the family. And the family, of course, moves in different directions, and some of them end up down in Atlanta, Georgia, in the Georgia area. And most of the collection ends up being shipped back to Georgia. You know, it's boxed up. Some of it is displayed in the family's homes. And when we learned about it, it was actually owned by three cousins that all had an interest in this collection. And they're all female, and they decided they didn't want to keep it. It was just too large, and you know, the cost for storage and everything was high for them. And because these documents in particular, you know, needed to be kept in controlled environments where the humidity and the temperature and stuff would be carefully controlled so the materials wouldn't deteriorate. And that was what they did that, and they did it well. They did protect what they had, and I appreciate that. When I was chairman, and I think it was 96, I got a call from a tribal member, Debbie Riddle. She was working, I believe, for the Shaw Historical Library in Klamath Falls. It's a private, well, it used to be a private collection from the Shaw family. Shaw family was a prominent family here locally. They made a fortune in the timber business. Most of that fortune came from Klamath tribal timber that was taken off the reservation here. They owned a lumber mill in Klamath Falls and so forth. And they collected different things, but most of their collection was historical documents and such. And ultimately, they donated their collection to the Oregon Institute of Technology. And OIT created the Shaw Historical Library. And that library has been funded through private donors, and you know, they've been maintaining that collection and adding to it. It is a great collection of information, and there's a lot of information about our people, the Klamath tribes, in there. But anyway, Debbie was working there, and she heard about this collection, and
Debbie
Riddle. And the Shaw Historical Library didn't want the whole collection. They only wanted the parts of the collection that were the written documents, the historical information. They wanted that to add to their collection at Shaw. And so they had contacted the owners and said, we want to put in a purchase price, but only for this part of it. The three cousins really didn't know what they had, and they didn't know the value of it. They felt they had enormous value, but they needed to make that determination. So they started looking to different areas to try to figure out, are there appraisers out there that appraise antiquities like this? And of course there are, and there's a whole market out there that deals in antiquities and Indian art. In artifacts, unfortunately, and some of those artifacts they shouldn't have, because there's, you know, cultural components to those, religious and funerary reasons why those are there. And but anyway, they have them, and so anyway, they ended up hiring this man that lived in Laconer, Washington, that was a certified appraiser of artifacts, and he worked in that realm and was well known. They entered into a contract with him to appraise the collection and then also come up with a plan for the sale of it to get the greatest return for the family. Well, he didn't actually know what he was getting into. He ends up negotiating an agreement, and he says, ship the collection to me. He didn't realize the size of the collection and what was happening. He tells me, when I meet the guy eventually, he tells me that it came up in multiple storage vans, big vans, and they said, where do you want us to dump this? And he said his facilities were nowhere close to be able to be big enough to properly house this and inventory it. So he ended up renting this old bank in Laconer, Washington on Main Street. It was an historical building. It was a beautiful old building, old brick building. Laconer, Washington's a tourist town, kind of. It's an old town. They've done a good job of preserving the local architecture and different things there. But he rents this building, this old bank building, big, big building. And he moves all the artifacts inside. He buys a whole bunch of folding tables and puts them in the lobby and in the main floor of the bank, and just spreads it out so he can look at it. The historical written documents he ships over to a friend of his at the University of Washington, who deals with those kinds of historical documents and knows the value, and he hired that person to appraise that part of the collection. And so they broke the collection up. Those historical documents, went to the University of Washington and the rest of it, to LeConnor, Washington, and he put it in this building. Of course, it created a lot of curiosity in that community. It's not a large community, but it gets a lot of tourist attraction. But he kept saying he was concerned because people kept looking in the windows trying to figure out what was going on in there. So he covers the windows with newspaper, taped it over them so the public couldn't see what was in there. And anyway, I hear from Debbie. Debbie says, Jeff, we're trying to get this part of the collection, but the other parts are available, the Modoc War and the basket parts. It might be something the tribe should look at because it's so large and it probably affects every tribal member there is, the way this, how large this collection is, and, you know, every family will probably have something that traces back to them. One of their ancestors may have sold a piece to this man, and he documented it. He put down names in his journal. So I listened to it, and I was intrigued by what she told me, And I went back to the executive committee, and back then we didn't call our tribal council. They were called the Klamath Tribes Executive Committee. That was really our name for the council at that time. And that was a name we had prior to termination. Our council was called the Executive Committee. So anyway, I took it back to the full committee, and I told them about it, and they looked at me and said, Jeff, we're broke. We don't have no money. And I said, well, I still want to look at it. I said, at least can I fly up to Seattle and look at it, you know, and talk to these people. I want to understand what they really have. I'm Modoc, and I'm Klamath, and, of course, the stuff in the Modoc War, I wanted to understand what was in that part of the collection as well. So anyway, the council says, yeah, go ahead, you can get a ticket and fly up there. So I flew up there, and the guy picked me up at SeaTac, and he was a big, tall guy, a little slender, tall guy. He was personable. I liked him, but he was an appraiser. And so he goes, well, the first place we're going to stop is, you know, University of Washington. I want to show you that part of the collection. And it's being housed in a building in the center of the university campus. I said, okay, then we'll travel on LeConnor. And LeConnor was, I don't know, 60, 70 miles north of Seattle. So we go over to the University of Washington, and we drive in there, and I remember we pull up to this older building, one of the first buildings that was erected a long time ago on that campus, old wooden building. It was large and it was old, but they had done a good job maintaining it. And I remember when we pulled up, this old silver-haired lady that was only about 5 foot high, she was really short, tiny woman. She came running out of the building, waving her arms, saying, welcome, welcome, welcome. You know, she was happy to see us. She goes, you got to come in here. I want to show you this. And I get out and I walk into the building. I walk into this room, and there's all these boxes stacked up all around in this room. They're file boxes, and they're all containing different material. And she says she's been going through each box, looking at each piece of paper, each document, and trying to understand it and put a value on it. And I remember that she put three chairs in the middle of the room for us, and we were talking, and she was so excited about this collection. She said she had never seen anything like this in her life. The collection had amassed all these different types of documents that she felt were, in her words, priceless. But that's the world she came from, and those kind of things really excited her, and I could easily see that. But anyway, she went on and on, and I was asking her questions about what was in there, and she was telling me that there was all kinds of historical documents and maps and papers about the early settlement of the region, and, you know, stuff about early people traveling through and writing about what they seen and what was there, and also contractual documents of land transactions and other types of decisions that were made. It's a whole bunch of different types of documents. Some of them that address the Modoc War, that correspondence that was going on between local people and the United States government and the War Department and different things like that. So there was all kinds of information. She was trying to figure out where it all fit and how to express it and how to write up a report and tell this guy, this is what you have. And she told me it was going to take her months to go through this. And then she gets up and she goes, you just don't know what you're going to find. She grabs a box at random and she's pretty strong. I was kind of amazed. She looked pretty frail at first, but after I watched her, she was pretty spry. She got up and walked over and grabbed this box and plopped it down between us. And she goes, you just don't know what you're going to find. She pulls a lid off of it, and she reaches inside, and she randomly grabs this file. And she pulls this file out, and she opens it up. And this file contains a lead pencil drawing of the gallows at Fort Klamath that this army lieutenant had drawn on the morning before this tribal member was going to be hung. And on the bottom of it, he titled it The Gallows of Spokane Ike. Spokane Ike was my great-great-great-grandfather, and he was hung at Fort Klamath. He was hung a long time ago for acts of war against the United States, and it goes back even further. He was the first tribal member on this reservation that was ever tried under non-tribal law, and it was after the treaty was signed. And he had a member in our family that got sick, and he went and he hired an Indian doctor to treat his daughter, make her well. And this guy agreed to it, and they agreed upon a price, and they entered into a contract. And so the guy came over with his helper to treat the patient, and he worked on the patient. His medicine didn't work, and she died, unfortunately. But under our traditional laws and custom, Spokane Ike had the right to retrieve everything that he had paid the man, plus as compensation for the man's inability to get the job done. He could equally take a life of somebody in that man's family. Art kill that medicine man himself. That was his right as a tribal member under our traditional laws. He decided to exercise his right, and he slayed that medicine man. He killed him. But all of our tribal people accepted it because that was our way. That, you know, he didn't have to accept that job. He could have turned it down. But he felt his medicine would work, and it didn't. And so that was a consequence of his failure. It cost him his life. The Indian agent at the time heard about it, and he was angry, real angry, because this had happened, and it was now reservation era. And he went to our chiefs, and he went to LaLakes, Chief LaLakes, who was our great chief at the time, and he said, you signed a treaty, And in that treaty, you said you would agree that all your people would follow the laws of the United States. And what this man did, Spokane Ike, by killing this man, we view that as an act of murder. And he needs to be arrested and tried. And LaLakes didn't understand at first what this Indian agent was asking him to do. And the man was incredulous, said, you have to arrest him. He has to be brought back. He has to be made an example, and he has to be shown that times have changed, and now you're under a different set of laws, and your people need to know that, and they need to follow these things. And after a lot of discussion, LaLakes relented and said, okay. And he sent some men to go get Spokane Ike and bring him back. What the Indian agent didn't know was that Spokane Ike was Chief LaLake's best friend. And also, he was married to Chief LaLake's sister. But anyway, he brought the man back because we agreed to follow the terms of the treaty, and we're honorable people. We weren't going to break the treaty. We entered into it, and so we followed it. And so the Indian agent took Spokane Ike, and he locked him up over at Fort Klamath in the brig over there. And then he went back to the lakes and said, we're going to have a trial. And since you're the chief, you act as a judge. You need to select 12 peers to act as a jury for Spokane Ike. And I'll act as a prosecutor, as an agent. And so he explained what a trial was. We'd never heard of a trial. That would never existed in our laws and our ways. And so he spent a long time trying to help LaLakes understand what a trial was and how it would work. LaLakes eventually agreed, and he appointed 12 men. And the word got around in our community. We have communities all over. You know, there was over 100 communities at one time within the Klamath homelands. And that's just Klamath. Modoc down further had their communities. We had communities all around the lakes, the marshes, the rivers. People had lived there we've lived here for 15,000 years, so people had lived in these communities generation after generation and raised families and lived their lives. And the word got around that this trial was going on and everybody couldn't understand what it was about. And so the Indian agent wanted that to happen. He wanted people to be there to witness him prosecuting Spokane Ike for this crime that he called murder. And so the day of the trial, they had the witnesses, and LaLakes was there, and they brought Spokane Ike over from Fort Klamath to jail, and they started the trial. And they asked Spokane Ike, the Indian agent, did you hire this man? Yeah, I did. Why'd you hire him? Because of my daughter. And he asked him what he paid, and he told him what the agreement was. And they went on. He said, did your daughter live? And he told him, no, she died. And we ended up cremating her in our ceremony, in our way. So you admit you then decided to do these other things that led to this man's death. And he goes, yes, under our ways, he explained that this is what he felt was his right. And he said, I decided to take that man's life for his failure to properly perform his duty. And so he says, you admit to killing him then? Yeah, I killed him. And he goes then to the jury and to LaLakes. Well, he admitted it. He's guilty of the crime of murder. You have to convict him and find him guilty. There were hundreds and hundreds of people there that watched this. My family, other families were there watching this. We'd never seen anything like it before. Anyway, after he was found guilty, he was taken back, and the Indian agent then explained that the jury had done their job. They agreed that he was guilty of killing this guy. So the jury was dismissed. And then the attention went to Chief LaLakes. Well, you're the judge. You have to determine what happens next. What's the penalty for murder? And an agent told him that in white communities, this man would be in prison for life doing hard labor. Or he'd be hung until he's dead. Depends on the circumstance. And he recommended that LaLakes be hung until he was dead as his punishment. LaLakes says, well, you've explained this to me, but you've also told me it's my choice as the judge or the chief here that I get to decide what I feel is proper and right in this case. And so the inmate said, yeah, you're right. You know, you're the judge. So the next day they brought Spokane Ike back. Everybody listened to LaLakes, and LaLakes explained that times had changed and those were our ways. But under this treaty, you know, we agreed to follow new things, but also, since he was a judge, he had to determine what was proper. And so he said what he feels is proper is that Spokane Ike have to do 2 weeks of hard labor cutting firewood for the old people. That was his penalty. Indian agent wasn't mad. He was angry. He was saying that that was a mockery of United States law. Only making this man do 2 weeks of hard labor is, that's just, you're just making a mockery of everything. And LaLake says, you told me it's my decision. And I made my decision. And so the Indian agent went back to his offices at the agency. They made Spokane Ike do the work and cut the firewood and hand it out to the elders. And life was to go on. But it didn't go on because Spokane Ike felt he had lost his honor. He had lost his honor. He had been made a spectacle in front of his people. He had been drug out. His family was exposed and to this mockery, and he, it just kept eating on him and eating on him and eating on him. He had to do something to regain his honor. And so after a while, he prayed and he prayed and he prayed in our old way. He asked the Creator for direction. He asked our ancestors for direction. And he had a dream. And in this dream, he ended up at the fort, and he was by himself. And in his dream, he was outside of the fort, and he was viewing the fort, making his decision about what he was going to do, and then he woke. So he awoke, and he thought about his dream, and he went to his best friend, LaLakes, and said, I've got to get my honor back. And I can't live this way. And he told him that I'm going to do something. And LaLakes understood. He goes, don't expect help. You know, if you got to do it, you got to do it. But don't expect help, war parties, others to join unless they decide they want to. But I'm not going to ask my people to do that with you. So anyway, Spokane Ike made his medicine. He prayed, he fasted, he sweat. Then that morning, he got up real early, and he rode his pony out there. And then, and just as in his dream, he waited for the sun to come up. And as he's looking, he's trying to decide what he's going to do. And he finally notices that all the horses for the port are in this fence outside of the fort. Over 100 and some horses are just there. So he decides he's going to take them all. So he had his paint and he had his ready, and he runs to the fort in the first light of morning, and he takes every horse that was there and he takes off with them. He didn't know where he was going to go or anything. He just did what he felt he was that came to him. And he went around the west side of a lake, and he went south, and he kept going south until he hit Klamath River. And then he followed Klamath River south. Well, eventually the fort, of course, realizes they had heard him. They watched him. He was war whooping as he was charging the fort, and they watched him do what he did, and nobody could stop it. It happened so quick. The Indian agent then went to the lakes and right away and says, you got to send a party down to track him and bring him back and bring our horses back. The lakes said, that's your order of the United States? He goes, yeah. So the lakes put together a group of warriors and told them to follow the tracks and bring Spokane Ike back and the horses. And so they find him south of what's known as Ashland, Oregon today, on the Klamath River in Northern California. And they found him camped down there with all those horses. And they rode up on him, and the men knew Spokane Ike, and they were asking, what are you doing? He told them, this is what he, you know, and they understood. They're all honorable men. They understood why he did it. They told him, we got to take you back. And he said, well, I expected that. So they took him back, took the horses. Immediately, he was placed under arrest again and taken back to the fort. Anyway, time passes, and the Indian agent never shows up to talk to the lakes. The lakes wonders, when's the guy going to show up? We're going to have a trial like we had before. You know, is what he expected. But he never hears nothing, so eventually he goes to the fort to inquire about it in the fort, and the Indian agents meet with the lakes and said, ain't gonna happen like it did before, because what happened before happened on the reservation. What Spokane Ike did was an act of war and aggression against the United States. He attacked a United States military installation. And Spokane Ike will be tried in a military court and a military tribunal, and they'll decide his fate, a military judge. The lakes had to go back, and he couldn't understand any of that. It was kind of confusing to him. Military court, and he had this other court. But anyway, the word got out that they were having this trial at the fort. So tribal people camped outside of the fort waiting for news of what was going to happen. And they brought in some military officers from other places to act as the tribunal. And they finally held their hearing, a trial, and they found him guilty of acts of war. And when the sentencing came, they sentenced him to death to be hung at the fort. I was told that story by my elders a long time ago as a young man. The man that told me the story was Freedman Kirk, a respected tribal leader who lived close by my family in Chiloquin here. He told me that the reason he wanted me to make sure I understood that story and knew that story, one, because it was my family, but more importantly was that it reflected change. Change that had occurred with our people, going from our old way to now being in this treaty and being under these new laws. He said that story needs to be remembered because that was the first time one of our people got tried by laws outside of our laws. Spokaneite got hung, but he had his honor. He was taken back and he was taken care of in her old ways. He was cremated. His remains that are left are at Wilson Cemetery, not too far from Chief Lake's, his brother-in-law. I visit that all the time because that's my family. And I take my children there and my grandchildren, I tell them that story. I tell them about being in Seattle at the university, sitting there, when this old woman randomly pulls this file out of the box. And this lieutenant draws this pencil drawing of these gallows where my grandfather was hung. They didn't know it. That moment, I realized that something about this collection special, that we left and we traveled to LeConnor. And I remember walking into that bank that day. And we walked in and the light was shining through those newspapers and it created this really weird kind of light inside the room. It wasn't totally dark, it wasn't totally light, but when I walked in, I looked around, there were baskets piled everywhere. There were bows, there were arrows, there were cannonballs, there were rifles, there were stuff from the war. Stuff from the war was over here, all this other stuff. I mean, the room was filled with stuff. I walked around the tables and I'd pick up a basket and look at it. And all the baskets this guy collected were exquisite. He always made sure that he only collected the best of whatever he could find. And every one of those baskets were exquisite. There was no tears, there was no rips, there were nothing. They were all perfect examples of our people's art. The war, I went over and I looked at it, and I seen the rifles and the bayonets, and I seen the bows, and I seen our flag that we made. And I seen, you know, the remnants of the people that fought in that war, that he was able to acquire their uniforms and their hats and their canteens and their rifles. He bought their personal journals if they had one when they wrote their stories about fighting in the war, fighting the Modocs. That's in this collection. I came back and I told our council that we needed to do something to get that. They all looked at me and I said, you have to see it to believe it. My words don't even express what's there. obviously it impacted me because a lot of different reasons I've shared here. But then I turned my attention and the council to how do we pull this off. The original price that they told us they wanted was $1.2 million for the collection. And we didn't have $2,000 to buy it. And nothing. I remember sitting down with Gordon Bettles. He was director of culture and heritage. And I asked Gordon, you know, what was his thoughts? And Gordon shared his ideas with me. And I brought Gordon to a tribal council meeting, executive committee, and we talked about fundraising and how we go about it. But before we could even do that, we had to come to an agreement with the family, and the family wanted to sell this stuff. And the guy that was appraising it, he knew the biggest value that he could get for the collection for his client, and his, of course, his percentage depended on what he sold it for. So the more he sold it for, the more money he would make. But this guy, I think he understood what it meant. I believe he did. Anyway, he introduced me to the daughters the cousins that owned it. We met. And I talked to him about why I felt this collection was important and why I felt their father had spent their relative, their lifetimes collecting this. And I told him it would be a shame if this collection was broken up into pieces and sold in Scottsdale, Arizona, or some other place where these things get sold. I said, that's a reflection of your family and what they stood for and what your ancestors did. Told me we should honor that and keep it together. At the end of that meeting, we agreed upon a six-month agreement. They gave the Klamath tribe 6 months to raise some money. And they only asked for three things. Each of those cousins wanted to select one basket or one thing out of that collection to keep for themselves. They already owned it. I mean, hell, they could have taken more than that, I guess, but they said they just wanted one thing to keep. He gave me 6 months. In the end, we negotiated down to about a little over $600,000. That was still $600,000 more than we had. And so we came back and you know, we talked about it. And I've always been led by one thing, or a couple of things, I guess, is that when I have a problem, I try to find the smartest people I can find to help me figure it out. I always figured if I surround myself with good, smart people, then maybe I can come up with a good solution. And that's what we did. We went out and found people that were smart people, good people, and they advised us. And we came up with a plan, and we went out and executed that plan. And I have to say, we did find one person in particular. His name was Dick Wendt. Dick Wendt owned Gerald Wynn, and it was one of the world's largest door and window manufacturers in the world, and he started his business in Klamath Falls. And it had grown and grown to where it was a worldwide corporation with 15,000 employees all around the world, and Dick was a businessman, but he's also part of his community. And his wife really cared about things like this. And she was a part of, you know, the Klamath County Museum Board. She involved herself locally in different things. And anyway, I ended up sitting down with Dick and Nancy, and I talked to him about the importance of this collection and why it should, one, come back to Klamath Tribes, but also why it should stay in Klamath County and be shared with everybody in some way. The documents, they should be there for scholarly research for lots of different reasons, because they're historical, they're original, they're important. The baskets, like I say, are a reflection of who we are and all the things around us, the tule, the dyes, the quills, the life. It's about who we are as a people. I look at a basket, it's not just a design on something. To me, I see my people in those. I see my people in each and everything like that. I do. And I think my people do, for the most part. They look at stuff like that. Well, I had this long discussion with Dick and Nancy, and they said, Jeff, we will match every cent that the tribe raises. And to start it off, he's handed me a check, wrote out for $175,000, and said, take this to start out with, and you can tell people that you've already raised $175,000. Took his personal checkbook out of his pocket and wrote that out. And he goes, if you get more than that, when you get the rest, come back and I'll finish it up and write the rest of my check. I shook his hand and thanked Nancy, and we went out. We put together this committee of Gordon and others and Leanne Hatcher and Jackie Galbraith. I don't know. There was a number of tribal people, Barbara Kirk, council members, other people, and we worked hard. We went and hired a professional fundraiser. I can't remember, his name was Tom something. He was out of Idaho. But he put together a plan, and it was a good plan, and we executed it. And I think in 2.5 months, 3 months, we raised all the money. And we went and we got the collection, closed the deal. I remember we had a dinner to thank all of the people that helped, and we invited personally Dick and Nancy for their generosity. We gave them some gifts, and it was a good deal. So anyway, we have that collection. Now the goal was, and we started immediately working to create a committee to build what we called the Interpretive Center. At the time, we didn't want to call it a museum. Most of us didn't, people have their ideas of a museum. We wanted something that our people could go to learn about who we are and learn our art, learn our history, to be able to do scholarly research, to be able to learn how to weave, and just learn. And we created a building at the time that was a reflection of the culture of the three tribes. We hired this architect that was renowned architect. He created Warm Springs Museum and a couple others. He was actually, his family was from the Project Irrigator area down there, which I found kind of ironic at the time, but he didn't want a farm. He was an architect. And anyway, we became friends. He created his example and we shared it with the membership, and at that time they supported it. Some people didn't like it. There's always people that have their own ideas, I guess. But we identified the area that we wanted to put it, and we acquired the property on 97 and 62, right where you turn off there. And the council back then said that's where we should build it, so we can capture the traffic of people going to Crater Lake and up and down 97. Plus, it was in close proximity to our casino. We hadn't built the travel center or the hotel yet. We had plans for that, RV parks and things. But we started developing the plan to do that and creating a committee to raise the capital to build it. And I always wanted to see us have something that was world class, that reflected who we are as a people, something that we could be proud of. I didn't want to build a metal building with four walls, and I wanted something that was, I feel something that's beautiful, something that when you step out of your car and look at it, that you're going to go, wow, this is really a nice place. The other reason why is because this collection surpasses any collection I've ever seen of any other tribe. And I've been to a lot of tribal museums across this nation. The only other museum that's probably better is the National Indian Museum in Washington, D.C. But as far as private tribal museums go, I mean, there's some casino tribes back east that, you know, man, they put $400 or $500 million into their facility. Beautiful. But when you walk inside, they don't have anywhere near the collection that we have. I know that. And this is, and since then, we've acquired lots of other pieces. We have an enormous inventory of stuff that we're just, unfortunately, not sharing. And I'd like to see that change. And we can do it if we put our mind to it. Yeah, we did it when we built the casino. We did it when we built the health center. We did it when we built our new tribal admin. You know, we did it in other places. You know, I know my people, when they put their mind to it, they can do extraordinary things. So it's unfortunate that we haven't done nothing with it yet, but I'm hoping that before I leave this world, I'll be able to walk in and see this, you know, and visit it. That's it.
Fascinating story to be continued. Thank you, Jeff Mitchell. I'm Ken Smith. You've been listening to Klamath Tribes Podcast.